If we can make things pencil out here, they can work anywhere else.
Looking for alternative energy solutions in Alaska from the Alaska Public Radio Network. This is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 24th of August. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a surprising find on an Aleutian island transformed by a volcanic eruption last summer.
I expected the only insects that would be there would be things that would had flown in from other islands.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. Learn more at rasmussen.org.
Alaska alternative energy efforts got some national attention over the weekend. Public and private sector energy leaders testified at a U.S. Energy and Natural Resources Committee field hearing. Senator Lisa Murkowski, the committee's ranking Republican, hosted the hearing Saturday at Chena Hot Springs. State Energy Authority Director Steve Hagenson told the committee that Alaska is setting its sights high when it comes to transitioning away from fossil fuels.
That, simply put, is to be 100% renewable for all of our electric and all of our heat and all of our transportation. Sounds like a lofty goal, but it's a stretch goal. I think Alaska has the resources to do it.
Hagenson said the state is following up on an inventory of renewable energy resources and generation options released earlier this year with a second report that will focus in on how to move ahead in the short, medium, and long term. The committee also heard about Alaska projects already in the works. Alaska Center for Energy and Power Director Gwen Holdman described an integrated hydro, wind, and diesel project in Kodiak that's pushing toward the state's objective.
Kodiak has a goal of 95% of their electric power being produced by renewable resources in the very near future, and they are really on track to achieve that with the first megawatt-scale wind turbines that have been installed in the state of Alaska.
Holdman also highlighted Energy Center work on battery technology that will stretch the viability of wind generation. Following the energy hearing, Senator Murkowski helped unveil the world's first portable geothermal generator. Developed at Chena Hot Springs, the trailerable unit is modeled after the larger generator that powers the resort. Owner Bernie Carl said the technology can be used to turn abundant hot water pumped up with crude oil into electricity.
It will be able to go to an oil well and hook up in 1 hour. There's 250,000 producing oil and gas wells just in Texas alone, one state. 150,000 oil wells that are not even producing. They're capped off. If we just took that, we could make 5,000 to 10,000 megawatts. Not my number. It comes from MIT. If we harness 2% of the Earth's energy, just 2% of it, that's 1,000 times more than the world consumes.
The portable geothermal generator is being trucked to Florida, where it will be demonstrated at an operating oil well. Senator Murkowski said a mix of innovation and integration with existing fossil fuel technology is what's needed to move ahead quickly. She said that the field hearing was a good reminder to Washington, D.C. that rural places like Alaska villages can help advance a national energy agenda.
When we talk about renewable energy and the opportunities for our country, it doesn't have to be large, grand-scale projects that are making a difference for millions of people. That Alaska can be viewed as that energy, the renewable energy lab, as some have suggested, and that if in a state like Alaska, where our energy costs are the highest in the nation, if we can make things pencil out here, they can work anywhere else.
Murkowski said she's taken to heart concerns voiced at the hearing about cost and delays of federal permitting. She says that can be a barrier to realizing innovative technology in places like Alaska where projects are smaller scale. Just over a year ago, Kasatochi volcano erupted and turned a lush, life-filled Aleutian Island into a moonscape. A group of scientists recently visited the volcano to see if life was returning. KUCB's Ann Hillman spoke with the entomologist who studied the insects on the island before and after the eruption.
Generally, if you lift a rock on a normal island and look underneath, you'll find a lot of things living down there, most of them very, very small. You lift a rock on Cassatoche and there's nothing. It's just sterile.
Derek Sykes is the curator of insects at the University of Alaska Museum. Last summer, he visited Cassatoche 2 months before it erupted. He found a green island filled with millions of insects. A year later, he found less than a handful. But even those few were unexpected.
We actually expected to find no insect activity. I thought the island had been completely buried in ash. The geologists had estimated the ash was over 800 degrees Celsius. So it was very hot and very deep. And I expected the only insects that would be there would be things that had flown in from other islands.
In addition to flies feeding on rotting kelp, Sykes also found wingless carrion beetles feeding on dead birds and one small spider. One cliff face was not completely covered in ash or lava from the volcano. This deep rock protected a small number of insects and somewhere between 11 and 18 different species of plants.
I walked along a long cliff face looking at the cracks and the rock at the base of the cliff, and I found a few survivors. I found one spider in there, which was a very hungry spider, not having much to feed on. And I found some of these carrion beetles that had been feeding on the birds, hiding in the cracks. And so that's what they do. They go and hang out in the cracks, and they wait until they smell a carcass.
Sykes says the beetles can go for a couple of months without feeding and probably survived the eruption until birds either died on the island or washed up. Cassatoche used to be a large nesting ground for many species, but now birds are having trouble finding places to roost. Some that tried had unexpected consequences.
There were some strange observations. We found both some dead birds and some dead flies that were recently killed by unknown cause. We guess it was some kind of gas coming out of the volcano.
The researchers could smell harmless hydrogen sulfide, but were not affected by other gases. Sykes says he's not sure how the spider got into the cliff. He could have floated on the wind from another island or hatched from a surviving egg earlier in the summer. Sykes says the beetles and flies are decomposers, the first insects needed to rebuild the island. They turn dead things into soil, which helps plants repopulate the area.
It's just going to increase in complexity over time, but you really have to have the base, and the base is going to be the decomposition community and the plant community, and then everything builds on top of those two things.
He explains that new types of insects will come to the island three different ways. Some will come by air, either by flying or being blown in storms. Others will hitch rides on driftwood from other islands, the mainland, or Asia. The third route is on animals. Birds carry ticks on their bodies and other bugs in their nesting materials. Some could even make their way off of passing ships. But the recolonization of Cassatoche will be slow.
So we're talking a long time period, maybe 100 years, maybe more. We don't know really what the dispersal rates are going to be like in the Aleutians, whether things are going to move quickly or more slowly. But the fact that we've had this survival of the plants and some of the insects has sort of jump-started the whole process.
Sykes says that he and other scientists hope to keep monitoring the island as frequently as possible to track the developments. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service already installed cameras on the island to document how different areas change over time due to erosion and other factors. Cassatoche volcano is about 50 miles northeast of Adak in the Aleutian chain. In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, caring for an ill spouse without help from the state's Medicaid waiver program.
You can tell it in her eyes when she realizes that she can't do some of these things. And that's kind of heartbreaking.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
The state's Division of Senior and Disability Services has been given permission to begin accepting applications for home care and community care services under the Medicaid waiver program, but only for people with emergency needs. Division Director Rebecca Hilgendorf says the federal officials set the criteria that determines who qualifies for assistance.
There are 5 points that we will be evaluating, including whether or not the individual has a terminal diagnosis of 6 months or less, a death of the primary caregiver, emergency absence of the primary caregiver, and anticipated discharge from an acute care facility within 7 days, and whether or not that person is a referral from either Adult Protective Services or the Office of Children's Services.
The authority to accept new applications for the program was suspended after a federal review found a backlog of some 2,000 assessments that had not been done, and that suspension is still in effect for non-emergency cases. A specific date for accepting the new emergency applications has not yet been set. Based on experience, Hilgendorf says she does not anticipate many people needing emergency help.
The emergency exemptions are for people who really don't have any other option. And so we don't believe that there will be that many.
People who don't fit the emergency criteria will have to wait longer for help. That means a lot of Alaskans are dealing with the daily work of caring for ill family members. APRN's Lori Townsend visited one Anchorage man looking after his wife and has this story.
That's Jenny and I up there in our high school graduation pictures. So it's the beginning on it, and then from there we went, you know.
Jim and Virginia Ginny Clark have been married for 46 years. They have 6 children, 24 grandchildren, and 4 great-grandchildren. Their big, inviting house is a shrine to a happy, robust life filled with love and family.
These are our children over here, 6 of them, and that's our youngest one down there. We have a grandson that he just left to go to as an exchange student.
Pictures crowd the walls in a big dining room with a long table and plenty of chairs tucked under to accommodate family, friends, and whoever else might tag along at mealtime. Jim is 78, retired from construction, and Ginny, 77, retired from Xerox, and then worked in the hotel industry in Anchorage, quickly becoming a top-notch employee.
People dearly loved her in that place. She was voted Employee of the Year for 5 years in a row, and that's all the hotels in Alaska.
But in 2006, a cloud settled over their good life of watching grandkids at Valley baseball games and weekend camping trips. Ginny found out she had Alzheimer's disease. Jim says her mother, sister, and another relative had also suffered with it, so they talked freely about what it could mean in the early days after her diagnosis. They told her employer, and things went okay for a while.
And then I went in to see her one day, and they told me that they were having some problems, so we just terminated. And they give her a big party, and her boss at the party made the statement that if Jenny, if all the cards that were sent in on her, with her, for her, they could paper the whole hotel with those things. So that was quite a thing, you know. But she's went downhill since then. And
now Jim spends his days watching her every move. He says he's worried she'll turn on the stove or try to help by putting away the clean dishes.
You never know where to find things after that, you know. She just doesn't know how to do anything anymore, that's all. It's unfortunate, but that's life. She tries, but you can tell it in her eyes when she realizes that she can't do some of these things, and that's kind of heartbreaking.
Jim says as things went downhill, he knew he needed help for both his wife and himself as he dealt with the steadily increasing demands of caring for her. He applied to the Medicaid program in June.
And we got all that accomplished. And we were approved, and then we got notification that the state had canceled any new on the 29th, so we missed it by 2 days. But that's life. That's the way things happen. You know?
He says the people at the Daybreak Adult Center have been a great source of support for both of them, and his children and grandchildren all chip in. But it's hard, and getting harder, as he waits to get financial and physical help for his wife. But he doesn't like to dwell on the difficulty. He says Ginny has lucid times, and in those moments, they have humor to help them.
You know, she would say, well, you know, my husband Jim would really like this when we're out someplace or something. And I said, yeah, honey, I really do. And she'll look at me and say, oh, yeah. You know, so it's, you know, it's, and she's got a great sense of humor. She really does.
He says they still dance in the living room when the Lawrence Welk show is on, and she still knows her children and grandchildren. But she tires easily, and Jim says as her condition has deteriorated, she sleeps a lot more and goes to bed early.
And so that gives me the evening, too, by myself, and I read a lot. You know, I go through at least a book a week, sometimes two, and I do that as an escape. You know, you just pull a curtain around you and forget the world.
But Jim says when he gets down, he sees others in a support group that he attends who have it much worse. Folks caring for wives or husbands who become violent and hurt themselves or others. He says waiting for answers from the state is frustrating.
Nobody seems to be able to give you a date, and who knows when it's going to be fixed. You know, I don't know whether it's going to be a month, 2 months, or what. So you just kind of have to muddle through until that happens.
The state is making progress. 8 new assessors have been hired to help plow through the backlog of people like Jim and Ginny Clark waiting for help. There is no timetable for when the federal government may lift the ban on the Medicaid program, but state officials with the Division of Senior and Disability Services say they will submit a corrective action plan on September 3rd. In Anchorage, I'm Lori Townsend.
Governor Sean Parnell and 6 commissioners served a picnic fare to thousands of Juneau residents on Friday. Some estimate nearly 10% of the city's 30,000 residents showed up. K2OO's Rosemary Alexander was there.
It felt like the 4th of July. Cars snaked across the bridge from Juneau to Douglas. Some parked a mile away from the picnic grounds. The food line was a city block long, and those who got there early enough were served by Governor Parnell and his wife, Sandy.
Hot dogs. His specialty was hot dogs.
For more than a decade, Alaska governors have been serving hot dogs and stuff to their Anchorage and Fairbanks constituents. But for Marlene Ibsen and an estimated 2,500 other Juneau residents, this was a first.
It was a great pleasure.
Governors have never held a picnic in Juneau. It didn't seem to matter when the governor actually lived in the capital city. Then Sarah Palin was elected. She lived mostly in Wasilla and worked out of the Anchorage governor's office. State government jobs have moved north, and only 3 commissioners now live here. The towns felt jilted. But when Palin resigned and Sean Parnell took over last month, he signaled a change, beginning with the picnic. Most of those who came to Sandy Beach on Friday seemed more interested in meeting the new governor than eating salmon and hot dogs, like 25-year Juneau resident Rich Lyon.
And I think I've met all the governors in the last 25 years.
What are your hopes for this one?
Oh, he's already exceeded my hopes. He's here. The big part of any job is just showing up, you know? And it's a relief.
A sentiment heard across party lines, even shared by Juneau Republican Representative Kathy Munoz and staunch Democrat Cindy Spaniers.
And I think this is just a great way to start the new administration. I think it's a really positive move on Governor Parnell's part, and I really look forward to working with him.
I think it's a very positive start, very positive. If nothing else, there's just a signal there that there'll be more communications.
While little tykes played on swings and slides or waited for balloon animals from bulbous-nosed clowns, Parnell gave high fives to their older siblings and shook hands with their parents.
Can I have a low five? It's good to meet you. Thanks for coming out. I just so much appreciate the people of Juneau who have turned out and who want to see us move forward as a state, and I'm just happy to be working with them.
Juneau hosts an annual reception at the governor's house during the Christmas holidays, and a legislative reception in January. Based on those, Chamber of Commerce Director Kathy Romick figured 1,000 might turn out for the picnic.
We couldn't even have guessed that the turnout would have been this big because we compared it to our legislative reception and the governor's open house every year, and we have almost quadrupled the number of people. We are guessing probably close to 2,500, maybe more, which is phenomenal.
Mayor Bruce Botello said the first annual Capital City Governor's Picnic did have a 4th of July feel about it.
I think the message he's tried to convey is his support for Juneau as the capital city, and that he, for his part, intends to support the role of Juneau in the state. And that's a wonderful message to be hearing right now.
Some local bloggers say the picnic is just lip service to the capital city, and Parnell needs to move into the governor's house to prove himself during his 17-month term. But 2.5 hours into the picnic, Parnell was still surrounded by folks of all political stripes. Guy Gleason was patiently standing in the long food line. He said it's just been the last couple of years that he's paid attention to state and national politics.
This new governor could bring some new life to the state of Alaska, and I'm pretty excited about it.
In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future, and by GrantStation, your fast track to funding on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years.
The Talkeetna Historical Society Board of Directors decided last week to cancel the town's annual Moose Dropping Festival. This summer, the popular event was marred by drunken revelers, rowdy behavior, and even one death. KTNA's Sue Dio has the story.
The festival has grown each year, and although one might think that means more money, Board President Rich Crane says it's not so.
As the festival has expanded, our financial return has dropped. The bigger it gets, the less we make financially.
This year, the festival brought in an estimated 5,000 people to the small village of 800. It just happened to have all the right keys to make what became a disastrous weekend. Alaska State Trooper Jacob Covey was on hand at the town hall meeting held on the 13th and described there what he and his troopers experienced during the festival.
I've been a trooper for 11 years. I've worked at Arctic Man 3 years. Arctic Man has anywhere between 15,000 and 25,000 people in an area now much larger than Talkeetna. And Arctic Man is more manageable than what we had this year.
Not only was there gang violence, there was underage drinking, drunk driving arrests, a reported armed robbery, and most tragically, a 22-year-old died in the Talkeetna River. According to Donna Dierman, that event and others got lumped into the festival discussion, even though it took place away from the festival itself.
It was a multitude of things that added to the problems that occurred that day. To single out the festival, I just feel, is not a fair thing. It's not fair to the Historical Society, it's not fair to the people of this community, and it's not fair to our history.
Mandy Hartley, business owner and resident, has been involved with the festival in the past. Her reaction to the board's decision is one of relief.
I think a year off would be good, and maybe people will come out and help. It's time for other people to step up and take a turn at the board, take a turn in any way they can to help.
The Historical Society will start to study new venues for this coming year's fundraising and have thanked all the many people who came forward with ideas for future money-making efforts. In Talkeetna, this is Sue Dio.
A year ago, the Alaska Native Cultural Charter School was desperately recruiting students as staff prepared temporary classrooms in an Anchorage church. This year finds the school in permanent quarters and showing a robust enrollment. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
2 days before the students arrive, Principal Tim Godfrey pauses for a happy appraisal of the upcoming 2009-2010 school term.
Last year, I felt overwhelmed because we didn't have the students. Now I feel overwhelmed because we are busting at the seams. And we've hired extra staff this year. Our enrollments are, I would say, 25% higher. We're trying to figure out how to fit all the students in. I'm excited.
In August and September of 2008, the Anchorage School District's newest charter school was struggling to make a 150-student enrollment. That's a crucial benchmark for state funding. This August, the class list posted on a common room wall shows some 180 students. 2 days before school started, the pair of kindergarten classes each had 18. Grades 1 through 6 ranged from 23 to 26 students. The enrollment cap for the Alaska Native Cultural Charter School is 200. In July, School District Superintendent Carol Como predicted a good second-year start for the school.
They've been very successful in keeping them, a lot of their families, and to me that's great. So I think now that they'll be able to come back, have a more stable population, and I think staff, if there were any staff that didn't feel at the end of the year that maybe that was the best match, they will have transferred someplace else and they'll be able to have a cohesive staff.
Como says it's common for new charter schools organized around a particular educational approach to lose a couple of teachers after the first year. But not the Alaska Native Cultural School. All of the original classroom teachers are back. Only the mathematics specialist is gone because the position was phased out in favor of a new math approach. Sixth grade teacher Martha Gold Lee is one of the first year veterans.
I would say probably for most of us, we were kind of glad to get the first year done with. It was a learning experience, and we are definitely committed, excited, and expecting great things our second year.
One first year challenge was its facility. The school started in temporary quarters at the Muldoon Assembly Community Church. During its second semester, the school moved to newly remodeled permanent quarters in the former Ashley Furniture Store on Muldoon Road in Anchorage's northeast corner. The premise of the school is to provide students with a teaching approach that fits into a Native cultural pattern while meeting district and state academic achievement levels. Godfrey says the first year showed a need to move from broad philosophy to well-planned, specific techniques.
Everybody was focused on what we generally stand for, you know, helping children that don't typically fit in a mainstream classroom. But we need to zero in a lot more in depth on that focus, our mission statement and our vision.
Godfrey says the federal No Child Left Behind Act and its adequate yearly progress report presents a third challenge, but one with benefits.
We didn't make AYP this year, but we didn't expect to our first year. But we have a baseline. What we got is scores, and we know where to build from there. And not making AYP was actually helpful to us because it shows us what direction we need to go in to improve our scores.
Superintendent Como agrees.
I think that their approach with the culturally based curriculum and teaching style is going to help those young people see value, and I think their scores will go up.
Beyond the cultural approach in the classroom, Gold Lee points to another school strength, parental enthusiasm.
Last year, whenever we would have potlucks, they would bring their fish. They would bring things that were dear to their heart. They were just so thankful to have a school and a place to be that was theirs. And of course, we have kids that are not Native here. You know, we had about 80% that were Native and 20 not. But the 20 that were non, there was really no distinction. There was that same giving spirit, that same sense of camaraderie.
In a second report, we'll look at the cultural teaching distinguishing the Alaska Native Cultural Charter School. This is Len Anderson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Rosemary Alexander in Juneau, Sue Dio in Talkeetna, and Len Anderson in Anchorage. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.